Hello and welcome to another TechNet Live webinar series. My name is Jeff Alexander. I'm a senior technical evangelist at Microsoft here in Sydney, Australia. And today I'm going to be talking on another topic around modernizing your data center with a hybrid cloud and Windows Server 2016. These webinars will all be made available on demand. So if you want to watch these on demand, you can watch them on channel9.msdn.com. And if you need to get in touch with me, you can get in touch with me at about.me/jeffa36. So let's get started with today's topic. So today I'm going to be talking about virtualization in Windows Server 2016. We've already talked about cloud and storage, and we've got some other topics coming up, but today we're going to be focusing on virtualization, which many of you are doing inside your organization. So as I talk through today, make sure that you keep that one word in your mind around virtualization. So today is all about Windows Server 2016 and the updated features in Windows Server 2016 regarding virtualization. This presentation is all based on technical preview version 4, which is currently available for free download. Obviously there might be things that change as we get closer to the release, but this presentation is based on technical preview 4. So let's get started. So from an agenda perspective, I first want to talk about looking back on what's been in Windows Server 2016 from a product perspective. And then we're going to talk about what we're doing around security isolation, availability, rolling cluster upgrades, and how we're helping to drive operational efficiencies. So let's get straight into it. So when we look back on Windows Server 2016, Windows Server in regards to virtualization, we introduced virtualization in Windows Server 2008. And we introduced some platform management changes in 2008 R2. And then really when we think about Server 2012, this is where we really started to introduce some of our industry leading scale and performance. Things like the ability to have a terabyte of RAM in a VM, and also looking at being able to have up to 64 virtual CPUs within a VM. With Server 2012, Windows Server 2012 R2, System Center 2012 R2, and also Microsoft Azure, we started to look at using Azure as a design point. And you heard me talk about in previous webinars where we talked about looking at Windows Server and also looking at cloud as an architecture. So we started to think about Azure as a design point. For example, a lot of the networking virtualization capability that we have in Windows Server 2012 R2 really came out of Microsoft Azure and those changes. So we've added a lot of those capabilities into the operating system itself. But you know, it's been around since 2008, so it's been around for quite a while. So virtualization has been around. What are we doing in Server 2016 to help with that? Now, when you think about where we are, where Microsoft is from a virtualization point of view, Gartner has had us a leader in all of the four magic quadrants. And one of those is x86 virtualization. And we've been a leader for some time in this particular area. And we are a leader in public cloud storage services, cloud infrastructure as a service, and also application platform as a service. And we're really the only vendor that is the leader in all these four quadrants. It's really important to understand that where we have come since we released virtualization in Windows Server and where the industry actually sees us in this particular area. So first section I want to talk about is security and isolation and what we're doing in Windows Server 2016 in regards to that. So we're seeing in the security industry a rising number of organizations that have been suffering from breaches. I mean, if you want to think about it, think about the Target attack, the White House, the US government. There's been quite a number of breaches in regards to these sort of scenarios. And these are coming from increasingly sophisticated nation state organizations that are getting into organizations without even those organizations knowing about it. And what we're seeing is we're obviously seeing an increasing number of incidences. You know, in New York Times has reported on the fact that there's been an increase in the cyber attacks on US corporations. And then you're talking about, malware that's espionage type malware that infects a raft of governments and industries around the world. So we're seeing an increasing number of incidences right now. There's a lot bigger motivations for these organizations that are doing that. There's a lot of money in it. Cybercrime is costing the US economy a huge amount of money, upwards of $140 billion, according to a report by the Los Angeles Times. And we think about how easy it is for these hackers to get in the case of a bank in the US, they allegedly stole unlimited amounts of cash from a banks in just a few hours. So there's very real threats that are occurring right now. And there's much bigger risks. Some of these risks could be coming from the inside, sometimes it could be in the BIOS. And we're even hearing that, forget carjacking, soon it will be car hacking. So there's a lot of change going on in regards to an emerging security threats. And what are we actually doing around this? Well, first of all, we have to look back on what virtualization has actually enabled over the last few years. So first of all, we've ended up with what we call a privileged fabric. So for those of you that are administrators or fabric administrators, the spread of virtualization in organizations has led to unexpected security implications. First of all, if you're a fabric administrator, more than likely you have probably the highest privileges inside your organization. That's probably higher than domain staff, domain administrators. You're probably the most trusted administrator. You have access to Hyper-V hosts and also all those VMs that are running on those Hyper-V hosts as well. And if you look at, as we start to virtualize domain controllers, if you're a Hyper-V administrator, you can very easily shut down a VM, copy the virtual disks, and get access to the Active Directory database file for an offline attack or to install software. If you were a bad administrator, you could certainly do that. And there is even a potentially have full access to tenant VMs in public cloud. So what we're introducing in Windows Server 2016 is a way for us to have strong separation between what the fabric administrators have access to and the workload administrators, and essentially allowing the workload administrators to still have that access. Say if you're a domain administrator, you're an enterprise admin, you need to have access to a domain controller, but there really isn't any reason beyond setting up the virtual machine that the fabric administrator needs to have access to that. So by implementing a technology called shielded virtual machines, we have the ability to separate that out. And we do this through the case of encryption and protected secrets through a service that we use in Windows Server 2016. And I'm going to talk about that in a second so you can get an idea of how that works. So what essentially is a shielded VM? And that's the obviously the question people want to know. It's basically it's data and state separation. So the data and the state of the shielded VM are protected against inspection, theft, and tampering from both malware and also data center administrators, making sure that only the network admins or server admins have access to this scenario. So we want to make sure, and when we talk about data center administrators, this could be fabric administrators, storage administrators, server admins, network admins. So we want to have separation between those two. So how things actually look today, when going back to what I was talking about a few minutes ago, is the fact that if you look at the way that we implement the architecture today is we have a server administrator that is most likely going to have access to both the physical machine and the virtual machines that are running on that physical machine. And of course, network administrators don't tend to have any access. Storage, network, backup operators don't tend, and virtualization host administrators don't tend to have access to these virtual machines. But the fabric administrator or the virtualization host administrator often does. They can have access to everything. They essentially have the keys to the kingdom. So what we're looking to do is we're looking to encrypt the VM state and the data that it contains. And we've done a lot of this work in Server 2012 R2 as a prerequisite to this, in the ability to be able to do secure boot in Windows Server 2012 R2 and to enable some additional security measures. But what we want to be able to do to take this further is to add some additional encryption algorithms on there. So encrypt the VM state and the data with BitLocker, and then we can control who has access to this particular virtual machine. So what we do, and essentially, is Windows Server 2016 has a new service that is running on it called the Host Guardian service. That does key protection so that we can allow us to store those decryption keys by an external system in a separate domain. So here you're looking at a cloud data center where we have a number of different hosts, and we have some guest VMs that are running on this. And these guest VMs have been encrypted with BitLocker, and they've also had the shielding put on for those virtual machines. And we have a key protection service that sits outside of that to allow us to protect that. So essentially, when a VM starts, it'll go, "Hey, can I have, may I have some more keys so that I can start this particular machine?" "Sure, I know, and you look healthy," and we'll give that guest VM that key so that they're able to actually start that virtual machine. But the building block that we have, as I said, is Generation 2 VMs, which we added in Server 2012 R2. We need to run on the current version of the virtual machines. We need to be able to boot from UEFI, which is the User Extensible Firmware Interface. And we put that building block in place with Server 2012 R2. This gives us secure boot, which essentially means that neither the UEFI firmware nor the VM startup files can be tampered with. Because not only do we have to protect from the virtual, from the administrators, but we have to protect from malware that might want to insert itself at boot time. This also enables BitLocker disk encryption to be used inside that virtual machine and allows us to BitLocker encrypt it so we can't do offline attacks. The second part of this is you're going to need a modern OS in the virtual machine. So Generation 2 supports only Windows Server 2012 and Windows 8 and later as your guest operating system. We are working on support for 2008 and 2008 R2, but I haven't heard of any timeline of when that's going to be available. Then there's this notion of the guarded fabric. So the next part of this is the guarded fabric, or what we call the Host Guardian service. This is a Windows Server role that can be used to implement a hardened fabric for that to store our keys. And what that does is this provides attestation and key distribution services so that the guarded hosts themselves. So if we set up a guarded host, so for example, you can go into Hyper-V and you can set up a guarded host so that guarded host can run shielded virtual machines. There's a host that sits within the fabric on which the shielded machines actually run. These hosts have to be identified prior to being trusted and must be configured to pass the attestation process. And then once that's done, the process of host guarding services verifies that a host is part of that fabric. A guarded host and is in the correct state of its configuration. Then we do key distribution, which is the operation of delivering a key to a guarded host so that it can unlock those virtual machines. And oftentimes that can sit within a separate domain to do that. So, example, when you look at the HGS service, must run in its own Active Directory domain and must be isolated from the current fabric infrastructure. This gives us that state separation so that you have that in a separate location. Now, looking at attestation. So, hardware, there's a couple of different methods that we actually use. So, there's hardware trusted attestation, which is essentially built on top of TPM, so our Trusted Platform Module. This basically gives us, obviously, there's more complex setup and configuration for this. So, you have to actually register each Hyper-V host TPM, which is its Trusted Platform Module, with the Host Guardian service, and have to establish a baseline policy for each different hardware SKU. And then you have to deploy HSM using HSM-backed certificates. And you're going to need additional hardware for this. You're going to need hardware that supports TPM 2.0 and UEFI 2.3.1. This is very similar to what's required for some of the security features that are in Windows 10. This obviously gives you the highest level of assurance because your trusted root is actually in hardware. And it is compliance with CI policy, which is for key release attestation. And you know, this is generally typical for service providers that would use that, but that's going to be a more complex setup. Now, of course, there's then the other option that enterprises might use, which is for admin trusted, which is Active Directory based. So essentially what you do is you set up an Active Directory trust relationships between that domain, authorize that host to run shielded VMs by adding it to the Active Directory group. most of the time you're going to see existing hardware is going to meet that requirements. And then that will allow you to do that. What this allows us to do is to protect data at rest and on the wire, even if that virtual machine migrates. And then secure disaster recovery if you're going to send that information off to a host if it's already shielded. Here you're going to have to make sure that in the case that you're going to have trust within the Fabric administrator. There's no hardware trusted or measured boot and no enforced code integrity, but it does give you a higher level than what you would have today. So if you look at the architecture, if you look at the modes here, so configuring attestation. So with attestation mode itself, the TPM mode is used only when you trust the hardware that Hyper-V is actually running on. AD mode is used when you trust the Fabric Active Directory and the Fabric administrators, which we would see most enterprises actually doing. Now in TPM mode, what you end up with is that it's necessary to configure a valid list of known EK pubs for the authorized hosts. And essentially what in Active Directory mode, it's necessary to configure only an Active Directory group. So a little bit simpler in the way that that's actually set up. So there is some key release criteria in TPM mode. The attestation service will validate the health of the host, and it does a number of boot and CI measurements to make sure that that is trusted. And then in AD mode, there's no trusted, no boot measurements or code integrity policies are taken into account. So the result at the end of this is that you end up with a shielded virtual machine. So essentially what is that you have a virtual TBM that gets loaded into the virtual machine that enables you to use disk encryption with FEM and allows you to do that. The other thing that we do after we've encrypted this, after this machine is actually shielded, the VM configuration files and VM state are encrypted even in flight with live migrations. So you don't have to actually implement any IPsec policies. The host crash dumps are encrypted. VM crash dumps are turned off by default, and they'll be encrypted if you enable them after the fact. So you do have that option for that. The great thing about this is that Fabric administrators have no access to the VMs. They can't go and attach debuggers to do that. And what we've done is we've hardened the VM worker process so that that's not allowed. They can't access BitLocker protected VHD files. They can't consult to the VM because we don't have access to the video memory. VMs can only run on known and healthy hosts via the host guardian service. So they're only able to actually run in that particular scenario. And this kind of gives you a breakout of what the architectures look like in that sense. So on the left, you have a hosting service provider where you've got a TPM. You've got the UEFI, you've got the host actually have TPM, and we have that key. And the enterprise one on the right is where we don't have the TPM, but we can set up a trust relationship. In this case, we're setting up a host guardian service on a separate domain, trusting our domain where our shielded virtual machine. So two different architectures. That are a little bit, the one on the left obviously is the highest level of security. The one on the right is giving you some better level than you have today and a little bit easier from a deployment perspective. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to quickly show you the model on the right. I'm not going to be able to go through everything, but I'm just going to kind of show you what it looks like once a VM is actually shielded. And what that host, that administrator has access to. So let's have a look at a quick demo on shielded virtual machines. Okay, so let's have a look at what we are actually doing in Windows Server 2016 to address this whole scenario around protecting the virtual machines. Now I'm gonna be playing the role of the administrator. Obviously I'm not gonna be setting it up with a separate domain, but I'm just gonna show you what it looks like when we actually turn on shielding for a virtual machine. So the first thing I want to start with is a couple of virtual machines that I have currently running in my environment. I've got a admin box and I've got a SQL machine. So if I look at the settings for these two machines, I wanna start with the building blocks that we did with Windows Server 2012 and 2012 R2. As you notice that on this particular machine, I have enabled Secure Boot, and I'm using the template. We're very much template driven at the moment at Microsoft. And I've also enabled TPM. Now, I've also, if you look down here at the bottom, I've got additional security profiles that I can add. We have no additional protection, data protection, and shielding. I'm going to turn that on in a second, but I wanted to show you what it looks like from both of these different scenarios. Now, I've also got another machine here, which is a SQL Server. Now, obviously, a SQL Server would be a machine that has a lot of data on it. And I've got Secure Boot enabled, but I don't have the Trusted Platform module enabled. So by having the TPM not enabled means that I can't actually enable things like disk encryption on this device. And I'm going to play the role of the cranky administrator, or the administrator that is not trusted. And I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to mount this VHD. I'm going to go to Browse. And I'm going to go and grab the actual disk for this. And voila, what you can see here is that I've been able to actually mount the disk that's on this particular VM, because I'm a Fabric administrator. I've got access to all the virtual machines that are running in my environment, and there's no additional security on this VM. Okay, so I can go ahead and actually access that VM. All right, so if I go into my local machine, what you can actually see here is that I could go in and I could go and grab the data that's on this VM, take it with me, and use for an offline attack. All right, so I'm going to go and remove that. I'm going to detach that disk. I'm going to go ahead and remove that disk because I don't want to do that. So I'm going to get rid of that particular disk, and I'm going to go and do a couple of things. So first of all, I'm going to go into settings on this particular machine, and you notice we have TPM enabled. And we've also got enable trusted platform module on this. And I'm going to go ahead and enable shielding. Now, I'm going to show you what it looks like when we start that particular machine. Now, what you'll notice right away is that you cannot connect to a shielded virtual machine using a virtual machine connection because we have no access to the video memory on this particular machine. Because we've turned on shielding, we are setting up state separation between the administrator for the virtual machine itself and the Fabric administrator so that they don't have access to that. Now, of course, with other machines here, which I don't have I don't have that enabled, you notice I get the video memory there. I can get access to that, no problem. Now, what does it look like inside the VM itself once I've enabled all that stuff? So to do that, what I'm going to do for simpleness of this particular demo is to turn on shielding for a minute just so that I can get access to the video memory so that I can have a look at that. I'm going to shut this down. Shouldn't take more than a couple seconds. I'm gonna shut this virtual machine down. And what I'm gonna do is try to, because that machine has got shielding and it's got a TPM enabled, to see if I can actually mount an offline attack on that particular machine. So let's go ahead and try that and see how that actually looks compared to a machine that doesn't have this enabled. Okay, so that's machines off, and I'm going to go ahead and try to mount an offline attack for that. And I'm going to try to attach that VHD. I'm going to go to the admin box, I'm going to go to the virtual hard drives and go grab the admin and choose OK. Because what you'll notice here is that this particular disk here is BitLocker encrypted. And you'll notice a message is coming up. It says Windows can't find that because I don't have the ability to unlock this particular drive because we have BitLocker encrypted and we've issued some state separation between those two administrators. What about if I tried to run the command prompt, the universal hackers tool, or the command prompt itself? What if I went and tried that and I went did /? It said drive is locked by BitLocker encryption. You're not able to actually do that. Okay, so we're implementing additional steps in this to help us with these particular machines so that we get in a state where those machines are a little bit more secure in those environments where we need that. Okay. Okay, so hopefully that gave you a good idea of what we're doing in regards to security. I want to move on into the next section, which is availability and some of the areas that we're focusing on in regards to availability. And of course, availability, excuse me, is always built around our failover clustering feature, which has been integrated into Windows Server for quite some time. Used to be called Wolfpack back in the day, but it's been enhanced in Windows Server 2016. First area we're focusing on is the area around VM compute resiliency. And we have this notion, what we do today, when we have failures in nodes within a cluster, we aggressively migrate those virtual machines to other nodes in the cluster. And in that case, that can cause a lot of movement around the cluster. So what we're trying to do is provide some resiliency to transient failures. These may be failures where something is, a service stops and restarts fairly quickly, or we have a node that's in a non-responding mode. And, we have configurable times that we can actually keep our VMs running, but not necessarily be monitored by the cluster service. The other thing, so in the event of a node isolations, these VMs will continue to run, even if a node falls out of being part of the cluster membership. And we can configure this with PowerShell, and the default is set that to 4 minutes. And what we want to try to do is to make sure that we're being a little bit more resilient to transient failures that actually happen. So when this server comes back up and running, we can take it out of that particular isolated mode and move on to that. The other thing is that obviously there are times where we see issues with storage, and we want to be able to maintain some storage resiliency. So what we'll do is we'll preserve the tenant virtual machine session state, even in the event of transient storage disruption. And that the stack that we're actually running is quickly and intelligently notified on failure of the underlying blocker file-based storage infrastructure. And what we end up doing is we put that VM into what we call a new state in Windows Server Technical Preview, which is called the post critical state. So that allows us to have some additional resiliency for that. Okay. Once it's in that post critical state, the VM waits for the storage to recover, and then the session state is retained on recovery. So we'll basically freeze that virtual machine so that its session state gets saved. Obviously, during that time, there won't be an access, but we will freeze it and then keep it on that node rather than moving it all around at that point in time. The other area is that we have a new setting called what we call node quarantine. And this is a case of where we have unhealthy nodes that get into what we call a flapping state. And a flapping state means that, the service might be stopping for some reason that we don't know. And what this capability does is it allows us to prevent unhealthy nodes from negatively impacting other nodes and the overall health of the cluster. So a node is quarantined if it is unexpectedly leaves the cluster three times within the hour. Excuse me. So if a node leaves that quarantine within three times within that particular hour, and we can set that, we can set the time frame that we want to have to do that. Then once the node is actually placed in that quarantine, we then start our migration instead of aggressively migrating like we did in the past. They're migrated from the cluster node without downtime to the virtual machine itself. Now, what that means is that, if the node gets placed into quarantine, we can then go and investigate what's going on with that particular node to see if there's any additional issues with that and sort out any issues with that particular virtual machine for that particular node. The other thing that we've done is we're not, with guest clustering, we're not bound to the underlying storage topology. So we've had shared VHDX for quite some time, which means that we can remove the need for underlying storage for the guest operating system itself, meaning that you can add VHDX files to multiple VMs and set up a cluster within a cluster itself. We've added a new feature in Server 2016 where we're able to do an online resizing of virtual shared VHDX files. It was one of the requests that we got being able to resize those files, you know, if we needed to add additional storage or we needed to increase the size of our shared VHDXs, we can do that without any downtime on the cluster itself. The other thing is we're streamlining how VM shared storage is out. Shared VX files can be presented to multiple VMs simultaneously. And what it does is the VM itself will actually see that as SAS disk, and it can use it for guest clustering, where you can set up clustering at the application level. We'll utilize SCSI persistent protections, and the shared VX can reside on a CSV or in SMB-based style. So if you have a separate location for your VMs up on a SMB share, you can put them there, or you can put them in CSV on block storage, whichever you prefer. The other thing is that from a protection point of view, shared VHDX will now support and fully take advantage of the Hyper-V replica feature in Windows Server 2016. Now, the other part around availability is around memory management. We introduced dynamic memory quite some time ago, and the ability to be able to resize memory and all that kind of stuff. So startup, now memory is an interesting one. It's, you know, you're always looking at memory as what a VM actually needs, what it actually wants, and what it's able to get based on what other systems in the environment actually have. So if you're setting up static memory, startup memory represents memory that will be allocated regardless of what the memory demand is on that virtual machine. So what we can do is we have the ability to do a runtime resize. And this is both increasing and decreasing of our VM memory without VM downtime. Now, the good thing about this is Hyper-V has also put in some protection mechanisms in this, in a sense that it cannot be decreased lower than the current demand. So it'll attempt to go and actually put decrease the memory to what you've actually asked it to do. But looking at the current demand that's on the system with all the other virtual machines and what's actually on demand for that virtual machine, it'll only reduce that memory based on what is going to allow that workload to currently run. And then, of course, like everything we do in Hyper-V, you're not allowed to change the size higher than the physical system memory that's currently installed in the system itself. Now, dynamic memory obviously allows automatic reallocation of memory between VMs, and we've been doing that for some time. What this allows for, and if you have workloads that don't require fixed memory for their workload, you can increase your density by setting up dynamic memory. And in this case, you see we have a startup memory, but then we have a minimum RAM for that. It essentially is there for increased consolidation ratios and reliability for restart operations in the case of something that's actually going on. You can also increase the maximum memory size now and or decrease the minimum memory without any VM downtime. The whole idea is to make sure we're keeping these virtual machines available. So let's have a look at some of the changes that we have and how it's actually reflected in the virtual machine itself. Let's have a look at a demo on some of the memory management changes in Windows Server 2016. Okay, so let's have a look at some of the memory changes that we have in Windows Server 2016 to help us with static memory and being able to dynamically allocate that. So I'm back on that administration machine that I was using before in the previous demo. And you notice that this machine currently has 1 gig of memory allocated to it, and it's working pretty hard. It's sitting around in the high 80s in regards to memory performance. So it's got quite a lot of memory in use and memory that it's actually using. So the workload's working reasonably hard. What I'm going to do I've had a request from the business owner that's running this machine. Say, hey, my workload's not running very good. Can you do something for me? But I really can't risk any downtime. So we're just going to go into the Hyper-V manager, and we're going to go and change that memory so that we can make that, handle that workload with the increase that workload actually needs. So I'm going to go into the settings of this particular virtual machine. I'm going to go down to memory, and you notice that we have dynamic memory is not enabled on this machine. We have static memory in here. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to change this to 2 gig of memory for now to see how the workload responds with that. And I'm going to hit apply. And I want you to notice as we move this over a little bit so that you can see my memory here in Task Manager. And I'm going to hit apply on this and watch what happens. Okay, what you're going to see is that this is directly reflected in Task Manager on this machine. So what we've ended up seeing here is that I got a request from the business that they needed to, their workload wasn't working very well, and we've been able to increase the memory on that machine, and we've halved our workload, how hard that workload is working, just by simply adding additional memory to the device. Now, what if that was only a seasonal thing or a period in time type of scenario? Well, we could go back and we could actually decrease the amount of memory that that machine has. And I could say, okay, I want to take it back to 1024. And when I hit apply there, now I may or may not get a message from Hyper-V that it wasn't able to actually do that completely. But you notice it was okay at that point in time. And you notice that the memory here has changed. Okay, so we're now at 1021 on the memory there, but there's a bug in Technical Preview 4 now from a instrumentation point of view that doesn't show up. I simply have to close that down and run Task Manager again, and that will allow me to do that. So if I resize this machine and go into Task Manager and I go to Performance again, you'll notice my memory is now reflected as 1 gig. And then if I go back into Settings, you notice that Hyper-V has looked at the workload and it's been able to allocate the right amount of memory to that workload itself. So hopefully these are some good things that are going to help with memory management in the upcoming release of Server 2016. Okay, I want to move into the next section in regards to availability, and we're continuing the availability piece. It's really talking about networking changes that we've made and around virtual network adapters. And you know, one of the biggest requests that we've had is the ability to hot add of NIC cards into machines. And we can do that. So the ability, administrators now have the ability to add or remove virtual NICs from a VM so that you don't have any downtime. Now, of course, there's some caveats to that. It's enabled by default, and you can only do it with generation 2 VMs. They can be added using the Hyper-V Manager GUI, or you can do it through PowerShell. So we have support for both of those methods of adding NIC cards into that. We also support any guests, so any supported Windows or Linux guests. So if it's a guest that's supported by Hyper-V, it will work with the hot add removal of virtual NIC cards. So even if it's Windows or Linux. The other thing we can do, and this is actually one of my pet hates, you know, oftentimes we have workloads that have a lot of network adapters, and those network adapters are doing different things. So we have what we call this ability to do device naming that flows from the Hyper-V Manager settings you see on the left-hand side, and then match inside the NIC itself inside the operating system. It's great so that you can keep track of what's going on. This is a new capability to name a VNIC in the VM settings and have that flow inside the guest operating system. So in this case, what you would do is you would add a new VM network adapter to the VM, whatever the VM name is, the switch name, and then add a NIC card to it. And then we use the pass-through to set VM network adapter and turn device naming on so that that name matches what's in Hyper-V and inside the machine. Very simple thing, but I tell you what, that's going to probably save a lot of people a lot of time. So let's have a look at some of the things that we're actually doing around VNIC enhancements real quickly in a demo. Okay, so here I am on a machine that currently has two network adapters attached to it. One attached to CorpNet and the other attached to an internal network. And I'm gonna show you some of the new features we have in regards to being able to hot add network adapters and also network naming. So if I wanted to add a network adapter with the Hyper-V Manager, we now have the ability to go and hot add network adapters, and that's on by default, and this is a generation 2 VM. And if I go and add that, put it on a network, and you'll see that that will show up directly in the network. Now you notice that my switch is called this particular name, and that switch is named that for a specific reason. But you notice it just comes up with Ethernet 3 in the operating in the actual VM itself. Now that can get a little bit overwhelming if you have a lot of network adapters as to which one is attached to where. So I'm going to go ahead and remove that guy. Say yes to that. And I'm going to run a bit of PowerShell code that's in Windows Server 2016 that essentially, and I'm going to turn off the what if thing because I really want to run it now. is I'm going to go ahead and run this. I'm going to add a VM network adapter to my particular VM, the switch name and the name I want to pass through for device naming. So let's go ahead and run that. Okay. So that's actually run. And if we go over to our machine, you'll notice that we end up with a new switch that's been added, and it's on the correct network. Now, if we go into the settings of that virtual machine, you'll notice here that we have a little name underneath called CorpNet2. Okay, so we not only have we named the switch, but we've named the name underneath it as well. So very simple things to help with your naming of your virtual machine, of your network cards on your virtual machines. Okay, so let's move on into how we're actually addressing upgrading from Server 2012 and 2012 R2. And we're introducing a technology in Server 2016 called rolling cluster upgrades. And let's have a look at how that actually works. So if you're here, for example, you're seeing I'm sitting on a cluster with three nodes, using some using some shared storage, pretty standard stuff. And it's running Server 2012 R2. And we're going to begin the process of being able to upgrade our cluster nodes without downtime for those key workloads. So what we can do here is that we can upgrade the OS of the cluster nodes that are currently running on Server 2012 R2, and right now to the technical preview, without stopping any of the workloads that are actually running, so that your infrastructure can keep pace with the new technology, but you're not impacting those particular running workloads. So let's have a look at how the process actually works. So it's a phased approach that we actually use. So first of all, what we do is we pause the actual node that we want to upgrade, and we drain all those workloads by using the inbuilt migration capabilities of clustering that's available then. Then the node gets evicted out of the cluster, and the operating system is replaced with a clean install of Windows Server technical preview. So once that's actually done, then we can add the node back in to the active cluster. And the cluster is sitting in what we call mixed mode at that point in time. And we certainly recommend that only being for about a month or so. And the process gets repeated to all the nodes until all nodes are upgraded to Server 2016. And at that point, the cluster functional level will stay at version 8 on Windows Server 2012 R2 until all the nodes have been upgraded. And the administrator, all they simply have to do is run an update cluster functional level PowerShell commandlet to update that cluster to Server 2016. Fairly straightforward process to go ahead and do that. Now, of course, there's a new upgrade process as well. Now, the current version that you're running right now in Server 2012 R2 is version 5. And then the administrator has to come along. So when a VM is migrated to the technical preview host, it'll remain in version 5 of that virtual machine. And so what you need to actually be able to do is run a PowerShell commandlet called update VM version and the VM name, which will take it from version 5 to version 7. So it's just a case of running that on those knows by running update VM version, it'll be migrated to the newest hardware version and can use all the new features in Hyper-V itself. Now, from a servicing model point of view, VM drivers, integrated, all that kind of stuff gets upgraded. We are changing the way that we're doing virtual VM integration components. They're going to be pushed directly to Windows Update as opposed to having to insert media onto the device. It's a cleaner process. And it means that we're leveraging Windows Update just like we do for other updates. So let's have a look at a demo of rolling cluster upgrades. Okay, so in this demo, I'm going to show you how we can do rolling cluster upgrades on a cluster that's currently running Server 2012 R2. So here I have a cluster called Cluster 01, and that cluster has a couple of nodes, and both of those nodes are currently running Server 2012 R2, and we're going to do an upgrade to upgrade this to Server 2016. So the first thing I want to show you here is that obviously we've got a couple of nodes that are currently running on this machine, and so we've got a couple of nodes One of those nodes is, you notice that we have FS01 2012 R2 and FS01 2012 R2, two of these, and they're both running server 2012 R2 Data Center Edition. And you can see they're both running that. And of course, we've got a role. We've got a role running on this machine. We have a scale-out file server, so we have a workload that we're using, that the business is actually using. And we want to keep innovating, and we want to be on the latest operating system. So we want to upgrade this up. So what we start off with is we first of all need to pause and drain the roles that are currently running at the moment. Now I'm going to start by going up to my first node in my cluster, and I'm going to go to pause. And I'm going to go and drain these particular roles. And what you're going to see is when we do that, it's going to move those roles off. So as we do that, you see it's draining those particular roles, and it's been paused. Okay, so effectively now we have the ability to evict this out of the cluster and do the upgrade process that we want to do. So which is what I'm going to do. I'm going to go and go down to more actions, and I'm going to evict this node out of the cluster. It obviously sends me a warning to say, you know, you want to make sure you want to do this, and that's out of the cluster. Now, at this time, what we would do is we would rebuild this server with Windows Server 2016, and let's assume, you know, and for purposes of this demo, to make this fairly quick, is now that that node's been evicted out, we've gone away and we've upgraded that node to Server 2016. We want to now add that back to the cluster. So let's go ahead and begin that process. So we're going to go over to nodes, and we're going to go and add node, and we're going to click next through here. Obviously, we're going to go and search for the name of the node. In this case, it's File Server 01 -TP, standing for Technical Preview, and we're going to add that in. So we're going to make sure it gets verified. Okay, so it's found that server. We're going to go and add that and hit next. Now, of course, we know that our cluster is okay, so we don't want to run through any of the tests that are going on at the moment. So we'll hit no to that. We'll hit next, and then we'll add all eligible storage to that. And then it's going to basically go through, and it's going to go and get our current node membership. It's going to verify that this particular server can become a fully functioning member of the cluster. And it's going and verifying that stuff in the background. So we'll let that run. And once the wizard's all finished, it says that it's been added. We could go and view a report if we wanted to, but we'll just click finish. And now what you notice here is that we have a server running Windows Server Technical Preview and a server still running Server 2012 R2 Data Center. Now you can run in this mode for about a month or so. So we certainly don't recommend you put it in mixed mode and leave it like that. What you would continue to do now is, if you had all other nodes in the process, is you would go through the same process of upgrading these, well, draining the roles and moving them off and upgrading them. So we're going to go ahead and onto the second node in this cluster, and we're going to drain and pause the roles on that. And what you're going to see is that our roles now are all running. My scale-out file server is now running against my Server 2016 server, and that is running fine. We haven't had any downtime in regards to that, into that workload. So we're going to go back over to our nodes, and we're going to go and evict that node out of the cluster. So let's click on that, and we're going to go down to more actions, evict that out of the cluster, hit yes. And it's going to process that, and aren't that node's out of the cluster. Now, of course, we've gone through the same process with the second node. We're going to rebuild that server with Server 2016 and pretend we're really, really fast when we do this. And we're going to, now we're finished with that, and we're going to go and add that node to the cluster. And we're staying with our naming convention. We're going to call it FS02-TP, add that in, make sure that that gets recognized. And once that's recognized, we'll add it in. Again, we don't want to go through and validate the tests. We're going to add all eligible storage to that cluster. Now it's going to go through the same process, making sure that that particular, you know, we're going to make sure we configure the cluster service, make sure that we're waiting for notification that it can become a fully functioning. Now, of course, you could do this all with PowerShell if you wanted to, but we're doing it through the GUI so we can show you what it looks like. And then once it's actually done, you'll see that both servers are now running Server 2016. And what we're going to do is we're going to go and run a PowerShell commandlet to upgrade the cluster functional level. Now, with Server 2012 R2, the functional level is version 8, and we need to upgrade that functional level. So we're going to go ahead and do that. It's going to ask me, say, now, if you, this is a one-way, this operation, you cannot reverse this operation, and you cannot add additional, you can't add any Server 2012 R2 servers to the cluster once you actually upgrade the functional level of the cluster. Okay, so we're gonna go ahead and hit yes to all because we want to make sure that it upgrades all of these. We'll hit enter, and that will go ahead and upgrade this cluster to version 9. And then once we've actually done that, that particular cluster is now running and fully functioning as a Windows Server 2016 cluster. So hopefully this gave you a really good idea of how we actually go about doing that, and a quick view at how we can go and update our clusters without any downtime. All right, so the last piece that I want to cover is what we're doing in Server 2016 around driving operational efficiency to help you be more productive with your Hyper-V workloads. So for the first thing that we're actually doing is the what we call production checkpoints. So previously to Windows Server 2016, in previous versions, we did not recommend that you use checkpoints in production. Now, in Server 2016, we'll be adding the ability to fully support production environments for checkpoints. So what this allows us to do is to create what we call point-in-time images of a virtual machine, which can be restored later on and is completely supported. Now, what happens is the volume snapshot service is used inside the Windows virtual machine to create a checkpoint of that machine instead of using a save state checkpoint that we used previously. So there's no change in the way that I actually use. It's very familiar to administrators. And really, when you think about restoring a checkpoint, it's basically like getting a clean backup of the server itself. And as far as Linux machines, they will flush their file system buffers to create a file system consistent checkpoint. And you see by the screenshot there before here is that we have the ability to, what we'll do by default is we will actually go and we will turn on, if you look at this here, we will actually create a standard checkpoint instead of a production checkpoint if for some reason we can't do that. Now, if you want to move back completely to standard checkpoints, you can do that. You can create what we call application. Create application consistently that currently take a consistent point of the application. So you have the option of doing the different scenarios, but by default, we'll be using production checkpoints, which is really great. The other thing is that we want to be able to bridge the boundary for administrators between their Hyper-V host and their guest in virtual machine. And we're implementing a technology in Server 2016 called PowerShell Direct. It's a secure way for you to issue commandlets and run scripts easily, and that's currently supported with Windows 10 and Windows Server 2016 guests on a Windows 10 Server 2016 host. So you get the ability to essentially do, there's no network connectivity needed. You don't have to have a network adapter attached to the VM. There's no PS remoting or anything like that. You just need the guest credentials and allows you to only connect from particular guests from that. And essentially, it's fairly simple. You do a enter PS session, VM name, and the name of the VM. Or you can do an invoke command to do a VM name in a script block in whatever script that you actually want to run. We've also made some additional improvements that we've had feedback from administrators to make Hyper-V. We can connect with alternate credentials now. We can connect via IP address. And we can connect with Windows remote management, which is great. But the biggest thing I think that we're doing in regards to make this a bit better is to start to use REFS as our file system for VHDXs. And what we're supporting in this release is the ability to use the REFS file system to do instant fixed disk creation and instant disk merge operations. So in previous versions of Windows, we were using the NTFS file system, which essentially has been used for quite some time, and has not been very good at the large files that we're starting to throw at it with later operating system. Now, REFS was originally used as a maximum data availability operating system in regards to doing rapid recovery from any types of file corruption. It's very resilient to power outage corruption, periodic checksum validation, data integrity protection, various other things. It remains an online during subdirectory reconstruction. And so that makes it a lot better. And it is now the one that you can actually use. And I'm going to show you a demo on how this actually compares, creating fixed disk of virtual disks on an NTFS partition versus a an REFS partition, so you can see that. So let's have a look at that demo of how we can actually increase our operational efficiencies in Server 2016. Okay, so I wanted to talk about one of the things we're doing to drive operational efficiencies in your Hyper-V environments, and that is about using REFS as your primary storage location for virtual machine hard drives. So just to give you a bit of a synopsis of what I've got here is on the left-hand side, I've got a PowerShell script that's going to create two fixed-sized virtual hard drives. Both of those are going to be 20 gigabytes each. And the second one is, and that's going to be doing that against an NTFS partition. And the second command is going to be doing the same thing, although I'm going to be creating six virtual hard drives at 20 gig each on an REFS partition. So the first one is going to be on the C drive here, and that C drive is NTFS. And I'm going to create that virtual hard drive in there. And then I'm going to do the second one on this D drive here, which is formatted as REFS. And just to prove that that is indeed the case and there's no smoke and mirrors going on here, here you can see my C drive is NTFS and my D drive is REFS. Now, NTFS itself as a file system has been around for quite a long time, and it was never really designed for the size files that we are throwing at it in the modern IT environment. So what I'm going to do here is compare the time it's going to take to do that on an NTFS partition versus the new file system in Windows Server 2016 called REFS. Now that that file system REFS was in Windows Server 2012 R2, but has improved drastically in 2016. So let's compare the two. Okay, so I'm going to kick this particular one off, and it's going to go ahead and create a couple of VHDs in this file. Now, as you notice, this process is not very quick, and you would be forgiven if you were bored, and if you had to create a lot of these, you'd probably go away and get a coffee. Well, we don't have time to be bored here, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to stop this just because we don't have the time to watch two of those being created. And I'm going to move over to my D drive, and I'm going to kick off the second script just to show you how this is improved using REFS. Same PowerShell script, but creating it on a different drive with REFS file system. Now watch how fast this is. Boom, done. That's pretty dramatic when you think about what's actually going on here. And with NTFS, it didn't really matter if you had a super fast file, disk subsystem underneath that. It wouldn't create them any faster. This particular laptop has two SSDs that are the same speed on each of these partitions, but they're just formatted with a different file system. So we hope that using REFS is really going to help to drive operational efficiencies in your data center and help you to do fixed virtual disk creation a lot more quickly, and merge operations as well.